struts like John Wayne, resembles Jim Carrey, and dresses like he's visually impaired. Because he is. Insight with Mark Farrell on the Progressive Radio Network.
Yes. Thursday. Hey, how you doing? My name's Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. I know these are still some crazy upside-down times that we're living in. But I must say, I'm feeling a smidge positive. More positive, I know that I'm always positive. More optimistic than ever. That number one, that Trump is out in days. And then number two, he's being impeached for the second time. Yeah, I know there's a long road ahead, but we're getting him the hell out of the office. We need a new president, stability. We need to move on. We need calmness. We need decisive leadership. We need COVID to be tackled. And we need him to be forbidden to ever hold a federal office again. Hopefully, if he's found guilty, he can never hold a federal position again. So that would allow him never to run for president again in his lifetime. Yes, I'm sure he'll be incarnated somehow. Oh, man. Right? You can't make this stuff up with him. Oh, man. You're going to meet Odette Schlegler today. She's an incredible executive director, just insightful, a sweet, kind person with a huge heart that produced a film a year ago on FOP. A disease that is just harrowing, and you're going to meet her and find out much more about FOP and the phenomenal people that are changing the direction and trajectory of FOP. So I want to talk about what's been happening. It's still unfathomable to think that only 10 members of the GOP party voted to side for impeachment. Only 10. Now, there's a lot of different philosophies about, okay, well, they're not going to say guilty because that means what they've been doing has been enabling the president for the last 4 years. Well, no shit. Absolutely, that's what they've been doing. Or admit that they're wrong and guilty and yada, 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 saving their own ass. But when do we put people first above parties? At what point in time? How much lower do we have to get? I just don't understand it. Am I pissed off? Hell yeah. You should be pissed off. This is just unacceptable on every level. All the information that's coming out that possibly that they were doing reconnaissance, the rioters the day before, that were granted permission even though they weren't having tours in the Capitol since March because of COVID. Somehow, this is what is speculated and going to be investigated. They got tours around the Capitol by potential senators or aides, or we don't know exactly, it's not been articulated, who were possibly giving them tours. But a very, very astute, well-spoken, I'm not sure, she was a freeholder. She was a former Navy pilot, helicopter pilot. Her name is Mikey Schriller, S-C-H-R-I-L-L-E-R. She said that she's trained because she flew a helicopter for 10 years in places of war, that she's always looking for things out of place because safety was always number one when she was flying a helicopter in the service. So she noticed the day before the riots that there were tours being conducted, and she made a mental note and actually made a complaint, an inquiry saying, why is this being happened? Why is this happening? So, and it was noted by a few other people. So the sergeant of arms, I believe the new one, because actually I'm not sure, but this was in the House or the Senate, because I think there are two different sergeant at arms. Anyway, it's been noted, was noted before the riots. And of course, they're looking at the tapes, and I'm sure they're going to do A-B comparison, who was walking around, if they used their real names the day before the riots, and were those people there, and did they penetrate the Capitol on the day of the riots? So much information to yet unearth. And yet, just last night, I can't believe this. This is really sad that a gold medalist from the United States swim team, which I believe was on the same team as Michael Phelps, was there and took part in the riots. He actually had the audacity to wear his USA, Team USA jacket while he's rioting. And now he's really, really easy to miss because he only stands at 6'6". He's got a beard. So the FBI identified him like presto. And I suspect, now the Americans, USA, can't strip him of his medal because it has to be the IOC, International Olympic Committee, because of the games that were taking place at the time. Now, does he actually lose his medal? Probably the physical medal, no, but he's stripped of the actual record. I think maybe his story may be reflective and emblematic of many people who are lost and get caught up in something like this, because he went from being a top Olympic athlete to within a year being married and having three kids. I guess he married someone with kids. And then a couple years later, divorced. And then homeless, living in his car, hit rock bottom. And apparently was making his way up, had a job in real estate, which he lost, P.S., he lost this week because of what he did in D.C. Did he penetrate the building? Did he go inside? I don't know. But he was there, and quite frankly, it was disturbing because he was right front and center in terms of where the physicality took place. So a few people are coming forward about the QAnon and how they got ensconced. Now, some experts are saying, well, because of the pandemic, people were isolating. People probably felt not included because they weren't going to work and they needed some form of structure or some sort of circle of relationships. But are you kidding me? You could do yoga online. You could have chat or group or membership or friendship online, but you rather choose QAnon, really, and have a wild, wild right extremist conspiracy theory and come together cumulatively with nutballs all across the country. Wow. So is this how it happens, the organic start of this? It's really, really disturbing. Now, with the 20,000 National Guard deployed at the Capitol, 20,000, which is kind of a weird thing to see because I guess usually they're out in fields and bases and locations of calamity. But no, they're at the Capitol building. And it seems odd to see so many troops there, and some of them obviously are resting because you don't need thousands and thousands of troops on at the same time. But anyway, it's just a very, very odd thing to see in our nation's capital. And more disturbing, or equally disturbing, is what is being touted as a equally violent act, possibly this week, where all the capitals have been put on alert in every state, that great violence, weaponry, and more could possibly happen. I just don't understand. If you're mad, use your voice. Vote. Yes, no, Donald Trump lost the election. You have people from both parties. You have businesses, platforms, people who would rather see Trump in office, don't ask me why, saying that he lost. But here we have thousands and thousands, millions of people who still back this guy up. Yes, his approval rating is definitely plummeting as we speak, thankfully. And it's still a very, very scary state to be in. When you watch those videos, I saw a few new ones yesterday. And the woman sticking a bullhorn in the building saying, no, no, if we want to really take this building over, you have to go this way and do X, Y, and Z. So it seems like it was quasi-organized, but it was just really goddamn disturbing. Still very, very surreal. What do you think? I mean, do you process this? Can you be like, oh, yeah, well, you know, what do you expect from Trump? I can't. And when you hear his words over and over again on the platform, the speech he gave, you know, the hour before this ensued, it is just laced and littered with kernels of provocative language that sets these people free. And off they go and off they went. And destruction is what they did. It's really, really disturbing. And see the officers. Oh, that's one thing I need to discuss. The officers, the colluded. Did they plan this? I hope not. But taking selfies and opening doors and say, right this way. Come on. You took an oath. This is what you're paid to do, protect people. And what the biggest question for me, well, 2 points I want to make is that if they did penetrate and get into the House and the Senate, actually, they got in one of the chambers. I forget which one. You know they're not smart enough to identify who's a Republican and who's a Democrat. So what was their plan? Were they to off anybody? With the Molotov cocktails, with the zip ties? What were they really going to do? Would they really have hanged Pence? Or is it just mob mentality, just bravado? I mean, scary no matter how you think about it. And one other thing that I thought, and then we're going to move on after this, very interesting that a lot of people are not bringing up, is that, okay, Trump came out with the videos saying, well, this is not what he meant, and this is what I said, and I would never have thought this, and people are saying it was a perfect speech. Of course, that's what he says. And if he was really, really hurt and didn't mean that to happen, why did he instruct Rudy Giuliani that night, hours after, not even hours after, an hour or two after the riots had been broken up, when people were still being strewn out of the Capitol building, to call senators, which he erroneously called two mistaken senators that he meant to call other senators. I don't know if that made sense. He miscalled two people and left voicemails on there saying, we need to slow this down. I'm calling on behalf of the president. He wants you to slow down the vote. So yeah, he was so remorseful, so torn up that he had Rudy Giuliani calling senators. Of course, he's a knucklehead, Giuliani, because he can't even call the correct senators. And he's erroneously leaving messages for someone else on another senator's voicemail. Come on. Yeah, he's really, really regretful. Only thing he's regretful is that he's getting caught, is that he can't serve a second term, and that he is fitful. He is full of rage, man. Of course he is. He has no platform. Only thing he's doing to communicate are his videos that are scripted. That he's saying words like love. I mean, have you ever heard that guy say love before, when except for talking about himself? Or polysyllabic words. I'm like, he probably doesn't even know what these mean, but he's just reading the prompter. You know? It's crazy. Anyway, so let's hope for really, really safe transition for Biden, for Harris, and most importantly, for you. We need this to happen. And yes, do we want a long, drawn-out impeachment process? No, we just want this to go away. But a precedent needs to be set, because we don't know how great and what depth these extremist groups are. We don't know who's planning really to run a GOP party or an extremist. So this needs to be set in stone that this cannot happen. This will not be tolerated. Punishable by law. And he is no exception. He thinks he's above the law and acts like he's above the law. And hopefully this is only one criminal act that he'll be tried for, and multiple other ones in different states after he's out of office. I hope he loses his pension, because he can lose his pension. I mentioned before, he won't be able to run for a federal office, so he can't become president again. He could lose his pension and many other perks. And you know, this guy's all about perks. He loves the word perks because it symbolizes, yes, I'm special, so I get special things. That's who he is, Donald J. Trump. Hey, my name's Mark Farrell. Thank you so much for hanging out with me on Thursdays. I hope 21's going better for you, a little bit better. Okay, a little bit better. You can settle for a little bit better. We're going to get through this together, each and every one of us. If you ever want to say hello, have a question, a comment, always feel free to email me, mark@markfarrellmotivation.com. Mark with a K, Mark Farrell, F as in Frank, A-R-R-E-L-L, motivation.com. So I had a great, great experience this past spring and summer, as I mentioned to you and during on the shows, where I came up with a concept purely out of frustration and remorse, not being able to do more for people, especially isolating seniors. So my mother lives in a community in Freehold, New Jersey, called Applewood. So I approached them, the senior community, the management, executive director, and said, hey, how about if we provide music for these isolating seniors? Well, how can we do that? And he said, I said, well, listen, I will equip my SUV with giant speakers on top, with an amplifier and generator, and I will drive around and sing and dance and play music like Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, and get these people feeling great. Let's raise their dopamine, their spirits, and get some smiles on their faces. He said, let's do it. And it was a gargantuan success. If you look on my Facebook page, Mark Farrell Motivation, you can see a plethora of video because I've been doing it at that facility and multiple other facilities. What's nice is that it's been a selfish act as well because I get so much out of this. To see people behind windows, and some of the facilities have balconies and they can come out or on their first floor patios. They sing, they wave, they dance, they throw me kisses, they hold their hearts, they are crying. It could be of sadness, it could be tears of joy. I like to think the latter. It's just so, so rewarding. And so I was able to do this at Christmas time as well. Some towns hired me to drive around, which was awesome. This was really, really the high point for me, and play Christmas music and stop. I stopped in the middle of towns, and I'll tell you more about this in a future show because this is something that we take for granted. Our liberties, our freedom, our health, and traditions. And I was able to bring just a morsel of this back for people, if not just for 30 seconds, a minute, or 5 minutes. And where I parked my car in the middle of towns and danced and made people beep their horns and have a beep off with one side of the town versus the other side of the town. And it was just exhilarating. People had a great time. And me as well. And I look forward to doing that at hospitals. I've been asked to do it for some hospitals, and we're working out the details for that. Continuing to do senior facilities and to towns. And I call it my mobile music and positivity event, where I can do it from the safe distance of being way far from a building. I have 6,000 watts of music and my, you know, words of encouragement and just making people feel damn good that things will and are getting better. We have a vaccine. We have a new year. We have a positive outlook. Like, we're going to have a new president of the United States, people. Does that resonate with you? Holy shit, it's amazing. Anyway, let's get to a great, great interview and a terrific person. A miraculous film was completed last year, and I was happy to have two of the main persons responsible for that film on my show last year. But one of the primary persons is joining me in the studio today. Odette Schlegler is the executive director and producer of Tin Soldiers. Odette, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
I just honestly wanted to have you because of your accent, not because of anything you've accomplished in this world.
That is so strange to me. Americans love the South African accent.
Of course we do. We love everything that's different. And not only that, you're easy on the eyes. But you've been doing, let's get down to the bones, you've been doing this passionate work for 20 years. And this particular movie is about how 900 known cases of FOP, which stands for?
Fibrodysplasia ossificans progressiva.
I could never say it so articulately.
It took FOP, me a year and a half.
is universally affecting 900 known cases, which basically means that ligaments calcify and become bone. And this film started about 10 years ago.
Correct.
Between South Africa and a relationship in the United States. Explain that, please.
Correct. So at the time I was working, I'm a journalist, an investigative one, and at the time I was working for a South African show, a bit like Your 60 Minutes, and we were doing just a number of stories in the States, and one of them was the story about a really interesting condition called FOP. And we interviewed a number of families, and on that journey we met the Kelly family and Amanda and Ian. And, you know, something really just stuck with me about that story. And FOP is like that. Once you come across it once, it sticks with you. And I think it was not just the condition itself, but also the incredible people we met along the way, Amanda being among them and her son Ian, just these people just stuck with us. And I was heavily pregnant at the time. So that was
heavily pregnant.
Heavily.
Not just pregnant, you were heavily pregnant.
Heavily. My daughter was born.
Those are my words.
My daughter was born a week after I arrived back in South Africa. It was actually pretty much this time 10 years ago. And it was interesting. The first thing I did when she was born was I checked her toes, because obviously that's one of the symptoms. It's one of the early markers. And so not only did the story stick, but Amanda and I kept in contact over the years. And then about a year and a half ago, she contacted me and she said, there's this first ever Brazilian meeting happening between Brazilian families and African families. And you know, is there a way to kind of document that and do something? And from there, developed this crazy idea to do a feature-length documentary that, you know, initially the intention was to shine a light on this condition and really, really bring forward the human story beyond the condition.
And I would say that this is probably phase two that you're in right now, because you're roaming the globe with very phenomenal success with screenings of Tin Soldiers. As a matter of fact, after we finish this great conversation today, you're jumping in a train or a car and you're driving 3 hours south to go to Washington, D.C. to show lawmakers what FOP is all about.
Correct. And I'm suitably terrified.
Suitably terrified. Why? Because they're going to realize how much brighter and more talented you are than all of Washington put together?
No, not at all. It's just, and I say this often, every time we have a new screening, it's a new audience. And
it's the unknown.
It's the unknown. And you know, when you've crafted something and it involves so many incredible lives and so many people who've trusted you with their stories, when you put it out into the world, it's like letting a child go out into the rain without a raincoat, and you don't quite know, you know. But we've been so privileged just to have every audience that this film has been shown to, from pharmaceutical experts and scientists to medical professionals and clinicians to people who are just off the street, like a film festival audience, it's always just had a phenomenal reaction.
And the awards and accolades should put some of that uneasiness to rest.
Awards and accolades are always wonderful because, you know, it's just wonderful to get them. But
it kind of solidifies your work.
It does. Yeah. But I think more than that is it kind of makes other people sit up a little bit and go, oh, well, somebody thought it was good, so maybe we should look at it because maybe it's good. And, you know, if you think about the competition in the world to get a film recognized, particularly an independent film that's about something as niche as this, and that also sounds like it's really sad, it's quite difficult to get those films recognized. So, but it's not just an honor and a privilege for me. For me, the accolade is for all the people that have shared their stories, and it's for them that I'm really proud every time an award wins the film wins something.
Very well said, Odette. And on top of that, it is a sad disease, but the film itself is not sad because you see the real definition of resiliency.
Correct.
With Hillary, with Amanda. There are trailblazing efforts, and Amanda's son,
Ian,
thank you, and Hillary's daughter
is Whitney.
Whitney, they're incredible, courageous attitudes.
Well, that's the really, for me, always the really inspiring and humbling thing when I have the privilege of engaging with people who are living lives differently, very differently to my own. Not only does it make me reflect on my own life and what I have and to be grateful for what I have, but they teach us the best in what humanity has to offer. So, you know, Ian, as locked as he is one of the funniest guys, one of the most insightful guys. I mean, I was in a conversation with him until almost midnight last night, and I'm like, Ian, I have to go to bed. You know, and he's just this incredible, incredible human, as are they all. Even Bruno from the favelas in Brazil, you know, that little boy can hardly move, but boy, does he play soccer well, you know? And they all just teach us something about living life in the moment, and about courage, and about, to your point, resilience, and thriving, even though the world has given them a poor hand, you know, to take that curveball and go, I'm going to thrive.
And it's about, as we mentioned, FOP, but it's really about the people, the humanity.
Course.
And, of course, making a documentary film, is that really is the crux, the message, along with how it impacts humanity in a very micro sense and a macro sense, of course, in this sense. It's a macro sense because the real impact is unknown because of the 900 suspected known cases globally.
Correct. So during the making of the film, when we were at the Brazilian conference, one of the doctors from South Africa kind of threw out a statistic, and he said, you know, globally, there should be around 4,500, 5,000 patients because statistically there's one birth in any 1.4 to 2 million people. And then we thought, oh, there's only 800 to 900 known. That's a lot of missing people, right? And then as documentary makers, as a team, we thought, well, this is another layer to the documentary that we just have to tell. And then what's evolved out of that is a true mission to develop an outreach and awareness program, a patient identification program, to find the others. And so, you know, I've said this often now, but as a filmmaker, your job normally ends at the red carpet. It normally ends once the film's been birthed.
It's out of your hands.
It's out of your hands, and then you
social
hope,
media.
And you hope you get a distributor, and you hope you got, you know, you get some distribution traction. And that's normally where it ends. But this film is very different in that it's only the beginning. It's only just started the real work in terms of finding the missing.
Odette, I imagine this is true for yourself, for Hillary, for Ian, for Amanda, for Whitney, and everyone in the film and connected with the film, that you are just re-energized after each and every screening because you realize, wow, how pivotal this is, how much of a difference this can make in people's lives. And the fact, the unknown factor, which we alluded to before, is gargantuan, and that's like the secondary or tertiary mission because of all these unknown cases and how can we maybe reach these communities, but the professionals in these communities, these doctors and lawmakers, so the word can spread.
Correct. So to that end, we've spent 9 months, almost 10 months now, developing an architecture for an outreach program that is essentially an awareness and education program. But in that, we focus very specifically on three areas of communications and audience. So first, to engage with a professional medical community, you know, the conventional medical community. And then primary healthcare workers, particularly in underserved communities, often that is the first port of call. So before someone's referred to a bigger hospital or an ER, they go to their primary healthcare clinic. So it's engaging with those healthcare professionals and then the community at large. And so we've developed this architecture. It's a replicable architecture, so we can start it in a country like South Africa, duplicate it, take it elsewhere, adapt it to different territories, adapt it to South America, adapt it to Eastern Europe. So that's the intention, is really just to drive this communication beyond our borders.
And has this actually come full turn in terms of actually hearing from someone far off in the distance and saying, wow, now we know what this case is?
Well, we've already started. I mean, we've only just started. And for example, we presented at our first medical conference last week in Cape Town, South Africa. We presented to about 150 pediatricians. Only 3 or 4 of them had ever heard of FOP. And these are pediatricians from across the country, but also across Africa. And out of that came a referral of somebody who thought that they recognized something. It turns out that child doesn't have FOP, but she has something else that she's being helped for. But also, it's beginning to connect to community. So we also just found out this week that there are 5 patients in Ethiopia that we didn't know about before. Now, those 5 patients, although they were diagnosed, they're not connected into a community, a support community, an advocacy community, and now they are. So on 2 levels, really, is how the outreach works. The one is to identify those that are identified, make sure they're all kind of in the family and in the database and getting access to this wonderful resource that exists internationally, but then also identifying other patients. And I'm very proud to say we've only really just started in the past couple of months, and we've already educated over 250 doctors who had never heard of FOP before.
Outstanding. Out of the 900 or so cases, Odette, and I don't mean to give you a lot of pressure here to answer this if you don't know it.
Sounds like pressure.
With the prelude, right? Nice setup, Mark. Yeah. Is there a bulk of a number in one particular part of the country?
Okay, so in
world, I should say?
In terms of the spread, you really just see that where patients are identified is really around in places where they have better access to healthcare, also better access to information, so access of being able to get onto the internet and do searches, and where patients haven't been identified, really. Like in Africa, for example, there are 21 identified. We now know of the Ethiopians, so that makes it 26. There should be 900 people.
And so it doesn't mean it's more rampant in the dense areas. It's just because there's available services.
So, for example, in Sweden, if you took the statistics in Sweden, you'd go, oh, it's 1 in 700,000 people, because pretty much everyone in Sweden who has it has probably been identified. But that's also because there's a mother in Sweden who is quite a well-known celebrity. And so she really has driven awareness in a very, very big way. So it's like ALS, like they used to call it Lou Gehrig's disease, because until Lou Gehrig got it, nobody knew what it was. And we have a very similar case in South Africa. A very famous rugby player got it, and nobody knew what it was before, and then he got it, and suddenly everyone knew what ALS was. So it's about really driving education and awareness, and we think we're doing it cleverly, you know, by attending medical conferences for those professionals, by really finding ways to access healthcare professionals in a very direct way, and then creating community campaigns.
And absolutely, and a clever foothold is the actual production of this movie,
Tin
Soldiers,
tool.
Itself. And let's take a look at the trailer, Tin Soldiers on Insight.
It steals childhood.
Devastation.
É difícil aceitar. Você não aceita que é minha primeira filha.
Foi bem comovente, porque eu não tinha ideia, né?
It's sort of like a trapdoor in evolution.
When I was 12, my left hip ossified, and that was like, you're not running, you're not playing sports, you're not going to the gym. You're not doing any of this stuff. And it was like, holy shit, like, that's who I am.
Eles podem brincar em outro lugar, mas eu não posso. Eles podem correr atrás de mim, eu não posso.
The body's soft tissues turn into bone.
It's a catastrophic disease.
People who have FOP eventually form a second skeleton.
The hardest thing, I think, is when she lost elbow movement in both arms.
Come and get me! Come and get me!
Really, it just meant that how he was a little tall and strong and a little stiff like a tin soldier, he was going to become more like a tin soldier.
He feels invincible, which is a bit of a concern for us. We don't know what's around the corner, so we'll let him do as much as he can now, while he can.
Claro que a gente pergunta, é por que eu, né?
It's scary to let your child go and be able to experience life.
But you tell it, don't jump too much, don't run too much. She couldn't care less about that. She will do whatever she wants to do.
Be careful you don't fall.
Don't ever think you can't do something. You can, just gotta do it differently.
He usually hooks the bait up, and then he usually casts, and I reel the fish in.
He's taught us to not be sad, and that he can have the best life he can, and he is.
We're on the threshold of identifying a treatment that is going to be effective for FOP.
Even for that moment of, you know, hopelessness that we had, we don't have that any longer.
It's certainly, you know, the most exciting time since I've been diagnosed.
That diagnosis is vital. If I was one of those mothers with a child, I sure would want someone somewhere to care enough to search.
We're coming. We're coming with hope.
When we have to find them, we just have to find them.
Remarkably well done. On many levels, the production value is incredible. You get a great idea of FOP, how it's just, you know, incredible. It's possibly ubiquitous. We don't know. But how people are sort of living their lives, certainly in that just the trailer. Obviously, the movie itself, certainly like Ian and Whitney, you can see how they're living their life to their, not to the ideal fullest, but certainly with living with FOP on a daily basis, they're really excelling. And I have to say, it's interesting, you know, if you think about like Alzheimer's, people are robbed of life. They become a prisoner inside their body. Unlike FOP, their physicality becomes limited. But I think their creativity, their spirituality, their productivity excels in a different level. And I find that to be remarkable.
I think absolutely. And like I said earlier, they really teach us the best that there is in humanity and the best that we can be despite the circumstances. And, you know, it was one of the mothers, after watching one of the screenings, said something that really, really affected me. And she said, for the first time, people are talking about that boy who can play with a soccer ball, or that girl who has her tattoos, or, you know, and they're not defining that person by the condition.
How does that make you feel?
It makes me kind of emotional because, wow, you know, it kind of means you did the job right, right?
Odette Schlegler is my guest today. She's the executive director and producer of Tin Soldiers, an incredible movie. She reigns from, South Africa via French.
Canada. Yeah, French. I was born in Montreal, but I grew up in South Africa.
I love how you dot the world. Noted as one of the 40 most influential people in South Africa. Under 40, you have a keen interest, obviously, in human condition, which is quite evident in this film. And talk about the actual, yes, we talked about how this relationship extends more than 10 years. But talk about the actual conceptual aspect, Odette, in terms of thinking, okay, here's this extremely rare disease. How do you structure this in your mind and when you put it on paper? I know documentaries don't typically have a script, but certainly have an outline to, obviously, for a footprint, for shooting schedule, funding, et cetera. And just tell me how that quickly kind of came to mind and developed.
Gosh, that's like a month-long question to answer.
And in 60 or 90 seconds.
90 seconds, we'll try. No, I mean, I think in any documentary, you're always led by the people and their stories. Mm. In this case, we had a lot of people telling a lot of stories. So it was who's telling which part of the story and how do you make it sort of interweave so that it flows, so that they're all coherent part of different voices but telling the same story. And then obviously the medical professionals, they tell a different part of the story. So we really just identify people who are willing to share their stories with us.
Was that difficult, narrowing it down or whittling down to 8?
In the end, we had close on 40 interviews. And so what was difficult then was to weave them into a coherent narrative. But I think this film does that very well. And I think it shows the diversity. It shows people from dusty gangland streets in Africa to the favelas of Brazil to Times Square.
Absolutely, yeah.
All dealing with the same thing in their incredible ways. And then obviously there's quite a lot of hope with the medical advancements. And then to interweave that story of the mystery of a 300-year-old fascinating condition, and even the stories of Harry and Carol, who are at the Mutter Museum, who've donated their skeletons there. So they were characters in the story as much as Ian was. You know?
I love it.
So we really are just driven by the people and their stories. And to your point, we don't go in with a script and never do. It's really that interview is about finding the essence of the story.
It kind of writes itself as you progress.
Yes. And then we sit in post-production for months and tear our hair out.
The magic happens.
Go back and forth and back and forth. But we do try and have a plan to start with. I've normally got these big, big, massive post-its around from our edit suite with like brain maps and things and how things will weave. And it never works out exactly like that, but it works out like it should.
It's kind of like life.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's kind of like FOP. You don't really know what to expect and when to expect it. You kind of have an outline, what possibly may happen, what age, the onset. And we're certainly hoping we know the outcome, that a cure will be. I think there, during my last interview that I had with Amanda and Hillary, that a drug clinical trial is happening.
There are seven drugs currently under clinical investigation. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. What would you say when you walk away from each screening is the number one feeling that you have? Is it hope? Is it, oh my God, there's still much more work to be done, or something else?
I think it's a mixture of being just purely energized, that's hit somewhere. And every time we come away from a screening, we come away with something different. Like the one at Penn Medical School the other night, it was that community that has spent the last 20, 30 odd years developing something. And they were like, wow, look how far we've come. And I didn't even think that was a thing. But in the film, you can see the development of this community over these years and how far they've come. And then also, I am suitably terrified of the work that we have ahead of us.
Yeah.
I think it's a mammoth thing to take on. It's such a rare disease, and we're looking for people literally in not even haystacks, but the side of mountains is how big the thing is. But, you know, Amanda Kelly said in the film, and she says it often, she said, just the right thing to do, right? And, I mean, I'm a filmmaker, but I've done this sort of stuff before. But, you know, once you're in it, you kind of have to go and do what you can.
Well, this obviously, Odette, I can't put words in your mouth, but this seems like it's touched the core of who you are.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, every film you do, you can't live the rest of your life with that passion. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to,
to
undertake other work.
Exactly.
But this one clearly has.
Yeah. I mean, every now and again, a story comes along, and I've said this a few times, a story comes along that decides it's going to get told, and it's determined it's going to get told, and then it decides who's going to help tell it. And I think this is pretty much the second time in my life that I just think this is one of those stories, and it chose us, and we are so grateful as a team that it chose us to tell it. And, you know, I couldn't have imagined where the journey would end when we started telling this story. But it's given me another thing, another purpose in my life, and I'm very grateful for that, as has another story that we did before, which has also led to things beyond the screen. And so as a storyteller, I'm just deeply grateful and humbled that my skill can do something more than tell a story on a screen.
Odette Schwegler, you've learned so much from this process, and this process, as you mentioned, is sort of just beginning. Yes, the film is in a can, and it's being rolled out to audiences globally. But what did you learn as a filmmaker, a producer, a director in terms of a macro professional gain that you would maybe you're aware of right now or maybe not until the next project you embark upon? But is there anything that's clearly like, wow, I just never realized, whether it's something connected to the story of one individual or a group of individuals or the way you shoot this or the way you just tell a story?
Well, I think you learn from everything that you do, and I think one of the things that I will take away from this experience that I hadn't experienced quite to this extent before is how it lands so differently with so many different audiences, and in each case, it still had an impact. And you know, the audience, apart from the people that have trusted you with their stories, the audience is the most important aspect to making a film, right? You're making it for someone. And in this case, the audience is so diverse. It's from scientists to clinicians to lay people to people with FOP. It's almost impossible to make a film that works for all of them. And we had one where we...
Though you try.
Well, we tried. We tried to make it very diverse. But, you
Absolutely.
Know, it's got a hold
it's
for
impossible.
Everyone. You can't exclude one sector. And, I mean, we were very privileged to screen to a private screening in Barcelona, which was mainly... it was hosted by a pharmaceutical company, and they have drugs in development. And I sat watching that and going, oh, my goodness, they must be so bored. They know about all the lab work. They know about what a mouse model is. They know about the condition. And the fact was we got this amazing standing ovation. I mean, they were so amazing to both Amanda and I. And the feedback afterwards was, yeah, we know about all the scientific stuff, but we didn't realize the degree to which our work affects those human lives, and it was hearing those human stories that impacted them. So that's very wonderful to see, and it takes the pressure off a little bit in future, going, oh, who am I making this for? And it's just if we follow the purity of the human story and tell it well, it's going to land where it needs to go.
And so you did. And one more thing about the medical community, and I hope they realize how much more work is needed.
Oh, I think
you know,
I think
that's
that,
a gargantuan.
I think that weighs
aspect.
Very heavily on anyone working on this condition, and I think others. You know, while it's a film about FOP, I think it speaks to many similarities in dealing with rare conditions or even not so rare conditions. And when you've got a child and you're waiting for this to come, and science takes as long as it takes, and I think everyone that we participated in the film, but even those that weren't, I think. Everyone working towards a solution for FOP, I think time weighs extremely heavily on their shoulders. They are very connected to this community, and I was humbled and really impressed by them as well.
And a close second to time is money.
Yes,
funding.
Of course.
It's amazing how much money was raised, how much more money needs to be raised, obviously, because the airfares don't come dropping out of the sky.
No.
Transportation, and obviously even applying to each different film festival.
Yeah. I mean, there's a cost in all of that. And it, you know, there are so many documentaries that would be great to tell, and thousands of them. And funding is always the biggest hurdle. And documentaries are not that easily funded, particularly for something niche, particularly for a company out of Africa. But in this case, we just had such incredible support from donors and families, and Amanda Kelly is a force to be reckoned with when she goes on her fundraising mission.
She is indeed.
She's driven. I'm really not good at fundraising, but so I really want to just acknowledge every single person who believed in us, because also I think, I mean, it was Amanda's decision to go with this filmmaker from somewhere from the bottom of Africa, and I think a lot of people thought she was mad. And I really.
How did you feel about that initially?
I was just impressed that she believed in me so much, and not just me. There's a really amazing team of people who made this film. I don't want to get emotional about it, but I know she had to push back a lot to go, no, but this is the right person. And I think we were the right people. And but so many people, from $100 to $1,000 to whatever, it took trust to go, I'm going to invest my money in this film and hope that it turns out like we all hope. And I hope it has. I think it has. But that is incredibly humbling. So, yeah, you know, absolutely. There's a very long list of credits to all those people.
Yeah. And, of course, we have to would be remiss if we didn't mention the website's tinsoldiers.org. And when will this film be, this incredible film, be available on a widespread basis?
Okay, so that's always, I think,
the million-dollar question.
That's always a process. So we start at film festivals, hopefully to get a bit of recognition. And once we get that, distributions look at it a bit better. So our intention really is to get it out as far as possible. So we don't have a commercial intention behind the film. Although anyone who licenses and wants to donate to organizations, most welcome. But really our focus is to get it as far as possible around the globe. So I don't want to say this on air just yet, but we're in the final stages of signing a deal with a global network that will start by distributing across a very well-known global network across...
A digital platform?
No, across broadcast platforms.
Fantastic.
In its entire Africa region, Middle East, Benelux countries, and a few more, and then we hope that Europe and the Americas will come online after that. And we have distribution shopping around. So
what's the timeline, possibly 6 to 12 months?
Yeah, I'd say that first one might be sooner than that. We're talking to other global broadcast networks, and once we get through those, then we go country by country. Like in South Africa, we can definitely get it onto free-to-airs, but we want to first get the global guys, and then we'll do the country by country.
For anyone listening to this particular broadcast or many other interview that you've done, or Amanda, or Hillary, and they can't have access to the film, how would you recommend they actually get access to more of this information? By
the website. So tinsoldiers.org has got everything about the outreach program. There are some short films about the program itself. The trailer's available there as well. And then very importantly, we've got a page there that says get involved. So you can get involved by donating, or you can get involved just by going, how can I help this? You know, to get this outreach right, we need networks and we need partnerships. Yeah. And everyone's got a network, right? So if every individual goes, I wonder how I can take this to my community. I wonder how I can spread it there. So get on the website. If you want to join the Tin Soldiers Army, we want you, you know.
And the International Foundation is actually the one who's been spearheading a lot of this for many years. Is that IFOPA.org?
The IFOPA.org, yes. That's IFOPA.org.
I believe Jeanine is the head, or a former president, I believe.
Yes, Jeanie Peepers.
Yeah, down in Florida.
Former president.
I was initially wondering if that was one of your first points of contact, because she's had FOP for how many years, how many decades?
Yeah, so she's 62 now.
I wouldn't want to mess with her.
No, she's a very impressive woman.
She is.
So in the original Carte Blanche story that we did, she was one of the people that we interviewed, and she has been so. We just didn't get to Florida with crews and stuff this time, but she has been so supportive of everything we do. Every time we post a photograph, she likes every single one. There's a little heart from her from every single photograph, and she comments on everything. She even today, I think she sent Amanda a note just to wish us luck. So, she's a wonderful, wonderful, almost mom of FOP to everyone.
Understandably, because, I mean, she knows first and foremost, not that Amanda and not that Hillary do not know, but she's living it every day. This is her in her DNA right now. This is what catapults her, and this is what also limits her as well. So she has a real, you know, she has a lot of skin in the game.
She does, and I mean...
And she cares. She's a lovely person.
She absolutely cares. I haven't had this conversation with her, but I've had a conversation with Tozi Kiki, who's one of the South African people with FOP, and he's also among the oldest people in the world with the condition. So he's
How old is he?
He's 53 this year. And he says, I'm very lucky to be this age with FOP. But
good for him.
When he was at the clinic in Brazil and he was talking to Dr. Kaplan and others, he said to them, this must be the last that this condition gets to my level. He says, I'm worried about the growing children. And I think that there's very this amazing like look forward. And it's not
just selflessness.
It's not just him as he's expressed it or Jeannie. I mean, a girl who's 28 years old, she's like, it's not going to do much for me, but it can help the children. And I just find that selflessness so incredible. The other thing that I find amazing is pretty much everyone I've met with FOP does not define themselves by FOP. It's like Ian Kelly is like, I don't go around every day thinking I've got FOP. I go around my day, you know?
He's worried about his next concept, how he's going to implement
it. Yeah, exactly.
Guy's
exactly.
So sharp.
You know, and I think there's so many of those human truths to take from the film that you come away with, and I think lots of people come away with different things. But for me, the one moment in the film is, again, when Ian's chatting about, you know, a possible cure, and we're saying, you know, how are you looking forward to that? And he goes, I don't live my life defined by when a cure comes, because you can't go, oh, I'll be happy when something happens.
It's today.
Because that's kind of it's kind of a crap way to live your life, right? Sorry, I said that on air. But
dangle that carrot. I mean, what kind of, like, it's people who live for the weekends. What happens to the four other days in a week?
Exactly. And isn't that something we can all take from that? Like,
sure.
I will be happy when I have a bigger house, or I will be happy when I lose 5 pounds.
I say that all the time when I give speaks. We have to take stock of what we have right now.
Exactly.
Because who knows what, I mean, it's cliche, but who knows what we have and where we'll be tomorrow.
Exactly. And, I mean, it does sound cliche, and everyone's like, oh, live in the moment. But when you hear that coming from somebody who has so little movement, who might lose more of that movement tomorrow, it kind of really hits home. It's
absolutely.
Like, okay, actually, get over yourself.
A very small example with my permanent visual impairment, there are clinical trials going on. I'm actually, with my anomaly of a disease, I'm an anomaly with that. So there are chances and opportunities for me to take a trial medication and see if it works, but I would have no interest whatsoever to do that, because if I could lose any part of my vision where I would not be able to see my kids or do X, Y, or Z, it is not worth it, because I can get around and do everything pretty much to, yes, would I want to do more? Yes, but that, like Ian and everyone else, it doesn't prevent me from pursuing my dreams.
Yeah.
And whether you have congenital retinoschisis, FOP, Lou Gehrig's, you name it.
Yeah.
You have to obviously be informed. You have to be driven. You have to be the pursuer. You can't wait for things to come to you, opportunities, clinicians, et cetera. You have to be the emboldened person and or have a team of loved ones that are a committed force, because you never know what's going to come down the pike and or make those opportunities. Like you do, for example, sorry to cut you off there, Odette. Down in Freehold, New Jersey, where I'm from, there is a restaurateur, proprietor of a restaurant. His name is Terry. He owns Shipwreck in Brielle, New Jersey. He heard about this through Hillary and said, you know what, I want to help, and put on a big, grandiose event at a huge organic farm called Beyond Organics in Howell, New Jersey, owned by Teresa Reed and Dave Reed. And there was a magnificent, just a gallant night of 300 people on a sod farm. Many of them probably didn't really know the impact of why they were there. FOP, what is the hell? What is FOP? But they came and they raised critical funds.
Absolutely.
They gave their time and effort. And that was a gargantuan foothold of monies raised that night. And it just shows that two people that just have a good heart. And what the cumulative power in that is.
Exactly. And I mean, some of that fundraising has already helped us educate and train 250 doctors who would never have heard of it before. So that money goes straight into that work. And what is so rewarding about the work is that we can go, here you go. here's this leading light doctor who had, before we spoke to her, had seen two people with FOP. Now she's been to the United States. She's trained clinically with Dr. Kaplan. She's seen 37. She's now going back, and by the end of the month would have trained another 100 doctors. You know, there's something wonderful in knowing that this work that we're doing has those results as quickly as they're already coming in.
Out of the, we only have about 30 seconds or so, Jed, but with your understanding in the medical science community, pharma community, what companies are very involved? Are they more stateside or abroad?
So one, and I don't want to get into too much here, but I know that some of the bigger companies, they're two American companies, and then one that's based in Europe. Those are the ones that I know are sort of more advanced with drug development.
Are they all pretty much on, the one in Europe is more advanced?
Yeah, but I think they've had some setbacks, but they're still working hard. And then I know there's one in the States that's had some very promising results.
Odette Schwegler, I would ask you what your next project is, but I think you are far from completed.
Well, I'm very busy with this work, and I don't think I'll ever stop doing this work if it allows me to continue. And in terms of filmmaking, the next story just hasn't chosen us yet.
And lastly, what is your goal when you reach Washington, D.C. in a few hours and present this film?
Our goal is to change hearts and minds and galvanize this journey that we're on to finding the undiagnosed.
And that you will, my dear. I have no doubt. Between yourself, Amanda Calley, Whitney, Hillary, and Ian, hello to all of them. They're just very magical and special people. And cumulatively with Janine and everyone connected in the FOP family, which the concentric circles are endless. Obviously, we're in New York City, and you're from South Africa, and that's just an amazing, incredible, phenomenal relationship that you guys broached personally and professionally. And thank you for your incredible work and journey, and just really understanding it. It's about the person.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, documentary films are about impacting lives, and I think you've done that on an extraordinary level.
Thank you, and thank you for the work that you do and the voice that you give people who otherwise might not have had one. Thank you.
Gary Nell is next, my friends. Be well, be safe, keep laughing, and keep living. We're getting through this together. We have a new president in days and a bright, bright future. My name is Mark Farrell. This is Insight. Have a great day.
Insight with Mark Farrell. Check out this and all Insight shows on the Insight page at PRN.FM. PRN.FM. Have Mark speak at your company, your kids' school or college. Mark speaks on critical topics that affect kids and adults everywhere, from anti-bullying, mental health, drugs, and alcohol to overcoming adversity. Visit MarkFarrellMotivation.com for more info. Insight, Thursday mornings at 11 on the Progressive Radio Network.